everyone. Welcome back to Behind the Science of Career Development. This is your host, Dr. Brian Hutchison, aka the Global Career Guy. I'm really excited about this episode, episode 9 here that we're doing today. I've been thinking a lot about college students lately. Part of the reason is that we have an article coming out in the September issue of the Asia Pacific Career Development Journal on working with Chinese international students in the United States. And as I was reading this excellent manuscript while it was going through the revision process, I was reflecting on my own experience as a first-generation college student. And the thought struck me, when we think about international students, students who are staying in their own country around the world, but also students who are attending university at another country, I started to wonder, what is the first-generation college experience like for all of us? What are the common factors for any student from any country going to a university in any country around the world? And so I started to look through my Rolodex, and happily, I came across a good friend and close colleague. Her name is Dr. Jonique Childs. She is an assistant professor in the College of Education Student Development Program at the University of UMass, University of Massachusetts Amherst. I almost said that wrong. I could see it on her face. But Jonique, welcome to the podcast today. How are you?
Thank you, Brian, for having me, for presenting me with this opportunity and this blessing. I am so happy to be here to talk about, I guess, all things first generation, because that's my passion.
Yeah, great. So you and I have gotten to know each other over the past few years, but I'm not going to assume the audience knows you. When you meet people and they say, tell me a little about yourself, tell me a little about yourself. Who is Jonique Childs?
Great question. Typically, what I always tell people is I like to think of myself as a social justice advocate for first generation college students of color. I identify that way because I tend to advocate on behalf of issues impacting these students.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what is it about your own lived experience that brought this to become such a passion for you? And I'm going to warn the audience right now. Once you get rolling about this, your passion just rolls over us. And I love that about you.
Thank you, Brian. I'll say my passion stems from myself. I'm going to say it. Me research, as they always say. I am a first generation college student. I had the opportunity of attending all of these different institutions and obtaining all of this wonderful knowledge. And now I feel as though I want to give back. I want to help the next generation, other people that identify as first generation. But in particular, I think the main thing that I'm trying to, I guess, bring awareness to is the idea that first generation college students, they come, I guess, into these institutions with so many different tools. And I'll say tools to be tools that could help them, but then at the same time, tools that could be also hindering their development within college. So I specifically want to, I guess, focus right now as we're in the times of what's happening. I want to focus on the concept of how are we tending to the overlap of the intersectionality of their race and their ethnicity while being identifying as a first generation. I guess the overlapping of those identities. So that's where I become more passionate because I want to bring awareness to this issue, Brian.
Yeah. And so as someone who does a lot of international work, and this podcast really has an international audience, I was starting to think of the idea of being a first generation college student is a form of culture shock when you arrive at universities, whether you're leaving your home country culture or not. For first gen students, and I think back to my own experience, it has all of the sort of mental health, physical health, and interpersonal health impacts on someone who is going to a different culture.
Brian, you just mentioned another key point to my activism on behalf of first generation college students. I'm all about the mental health of these students. Mm. Unfortunately, barriers that are systemic in nature, unfortunately, is impacting our students, our first generation students of color. And unfortunately, these barriers, in my opinion, is, I'm going to say it, hindering the access and the equity of first generation college students. May that be students that's here in the United States and that's students outside. So I like the perspective of global. We need to be thinking about our first generation college students that are here in the United States, but what about the ones that are all around the world that are facing these barriers that could be related to their race?
Right. Yeah. And so just let's, if we start to think about the United States, right? So we're talking about first generation college students of color from the US and how that is a culture shock and is a detriment to their equitable access to education and what we gain from it. There's also racism, sexism, and a lot of other prejudices. And then in our current environment, we add international students who are often also students of color to the mix. And we get this really complex environment that makes it very difficult on the mental health and wellness for those students. So if we were to sort of like start with the basics from your research and the research that you know, what are some of the sort of confounding factors that a student confronts when they come to a university as a first generation college student of any kind?
Perfect. Thank you for allowing me to go into a little bit of my research. Based on what I've learned, first generation college students, they encounter barriers that relate to the financial aspect, the financial burden. They encounter barriers related to disparity, related to access to opportunities when they're on college campuses. Just going down a list of some of the barriers impacting students of color as it relates to their race. These students are encountering oppression and implicit biases as they are entering predominantly white institutions. Within these institutions, that comes with the disparity in the ability to access services on college campuses. That would include the utilization of college counseling and the utilization of career services. My research has cited or has added to the literature to point out that unfortunately, first generation college students of color are unwilling to seek help within these institutions because they are encountering microaggressions. They are encountering that implicit bias, the implicit biases. And all of that is becoming detrimental to their mental health, which is unfortunately impacting their ability to succeed or finish or accomplish that American dream that they're so-called promised. So my research is highlighting the need that we need to create some form of some systematic or systemic changes within predominantly white institutions to support first generation college students of color. May that be international, global, whatever.
Right.
We have to focus on their mental health as it pertains to the barrier of race.
Great. Great. And so as my listeners know, I like to play terminology cop a little bit here. And so I want to rewind a little bit and make sure that we have good working definitions. And so I'd like to start with implicit bias, because I see this in the media a lot, but most often when I see it used as a term, it's rarely defined accurately. So when you think of the term, and I can maybe help out a little bit, but like think of the term implicit bias, like how would you describe that to someone who doesn't have your training and expertise?
Yes, great question. Implicit bias, in my opinion, can be based on the conscious and unconscious attitudes, values, and stances that we take towards a person that can come out within our actions and or our words and or behavior. Implicit biases come up with the things that unconsciously that we don't even know we do, such as how we address a person, how we describe a person, how we attend to the presenting needs of a client or a student. All of that, we have to, I guess, take a step back and think about how we are assessing the situation. Because typically those implicit biases are those blind spots that we have that we don't even know we hold about an individual or a situation or a circumstance.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think a couple of threats to people mentally when they hear that term, if it sort of is something they want to push away, is that first of all, everyone has implicit bias, right? Our brain structures are engineered to save resources by making assumptions, by making patterned reactions in our thinking about things. And so it's a universal idea that implicit biases are in all of us. It's the way that we're built. And the second thing is that having implicit biases doesn't mean that you're a bad person, because as you said, they're unconscious. Mm-hmm. And luckily, we have this capacity with a pause and a reflection to actually reveal these thinking patterns, these habits of mind, and actually change ourselves. And so I think a lot more work needs to be done in the general population of embracing a reality about this idea in a way that everyone can say, oh, we all have to do this work together.
As you point out work, my thing is, those implicit biases can come up as we're assisting our students or our clients, right? Specifically, the stereotypes that comes up with occupations or specific college majors, all of that occurs within that career counseling, that career development process. So we must be in tune and become aware of that.
Yeah. And if I can share a personal example, right? Because like we all have this and I have this and I have worked on this. I'm writing a paper right now on career development for persons of the Islamic faith in the United States. And it's all prompted by a very close student and colleague now of mine who is a Muslim woman that wears hijab. And when I first met her, I had no personal experience. And so when we have no intergroup contact with people, we wouldn't have taken that moment of reflection to actually pause our automatic thoughts and learn. And it has really turned into one of the greatest sort of professional relationships of my career, because I have learned so much by being able to work with the Muslim community, specifically in St. Louis, Missouri. So if we think about it, we all have these moments where we've had to go through this work, as you say, particularly if we help diverse groups of other people.
I can give you an example from one of my rich work experiences. In working in a university counseling center, I had to take on that role to be that advocate or that voice for marginalized students on this predominantly white campus or predominantly white institution. Interesting to know that 33% or one third of the student population identified as students of color. And I will say that my visible presence or being a minority woman on the college campus prompted the students to reach out to me to come into counseling to discuss their multiple identities that they held, being a first generation student, being a student of color, being from a low socioeconomic background, being a student that represent from a sexual orientation that is not openly embraced or accepted. All of these different constructs of their identities played a role on their mental health. Yeah. And I guess my example led me into knowing that I had to create some form of a campaign on that university campus to make sure that we were attending to students of color, their specific needs as it relates to their mental health. Because unfortunately, part of that barrier that these students encounter is that ability to be embraced or be welcome, that social isolation piece that these students encounter. Mm-hmm. So the key is to figure out how we go about uncovering our implicit biases as we're working with people that we don't really know. But as we're seeking to learn from them, we go into this with an open mind. Mm-hmm. Be mindful of how we are figuring out which ways we help the student to share their identities, because unfortunately those identities can be connected to some historical, and I'm going to say it, rooted racism and oppression. Absolutely. That's related to their identity. And we must, I guess, keep that in mind.
Yeah. And I really think open-mindedness and in my mind, humility is important.
Yes.
So for example, there's preponderance of research now, these sort of one-time implicit bias trainings that are very popular on college campuses and in corporations don't seem to work. They don't seem to have outcomes. And so a stance of open-mindedness and humility allows us to let data and science influence us and say, this work is still necessary, but we need to be able to try different things. We need to be able to map out multiple journeys, evaluating those pathways that we have mapped out and adapt ourselves.
Brian, it's interesting that we are, I guess, verging on that topic of cultural humility. That is one of the areas that I have highly focused on when I was doing my doctoral training. And it's the first article that I solo published straight out of my doc program, where I talk about my experiences as being a multicultural supervisor, students that I was training that are from a different racial ethnic background, and how as a supervisor, I engaged in that ability to be culturally humble, supported by literature and research. So I agree with you to be culturally humble is to have that willingness to take that step down, to be open to learning and exploring others and their culture.
Yeah. I've been doing this work for a while. And as a clinical supervisor, I find that broaching, which is something that I train on quite a bit, tends to be one of the most terrifying actions that you can ask of a new counselor or a new coach in the career field. And it's the idea that we put the idea of culture and identity on the table and then open ourselves up with humility to being corrected by our clients, being directed by our clients, being shown the things that we don't know and are not yet aware of. You called them blind spots. I love that term. And that our clients are actually sort of reciprocating back to us, and we're not just the expert in the room.
But the key to being culturally humble, as I like to call it, is to have that willingness.
Yep.
It starts first with the willingness to humble yourself.
Love it.
It starts with your willingness to meet a person where they are and to take out those blind spots or to become aware of them so that we could do the work with the client and tackle or broach those sensitive topics of what's actually happening with our clients.
Yeah. I want to key into one more word as part of this conversation or term that you use, because I think the implicit bias stuff for me is about our internal world. But then if we turn it to the external world, the relationship world, we see the term microaggression used quite a bit. And microaggressions, in my mind, are often observable, and we might observe them in ourselves because of these biases, but we also might observe them in the workplace where we are a person that has different levels of power and privilege in any given moment, depending on the context. But when you try to describe microaggressions to the layperson who hasn't had your training, how do you describe that?
Oh, Brian, I have to go there. Microaggressions, there's so many different types of microaggressions out there. How I like to think of it, just based on my research in exploring first-generation college students of color and their occurrence with microaggressions on these predominantly white institutions, microaggressions come in the form of devaluation. Microaggressions come in the form of the conversation, those well-intentioned conversations that we have with our students or with our colleagues, but unfortunately, it comes with bias. It comes with the questioning of what was the intent behind what you said. Was the intent to hurt, or was it the intent to elevate or help? I guess it's the way we communicate. I'll be basic as I say this when we talk about microaggressions. It's the verbal or the nonverbal ways in which we communicate acceptance or embracing of another person's, their culture identity, all of those identities that we talked about. Microaggressions are those slight slurs, those insults that make an individual feels as though they are being questioned related to their humanity. These microaggressions, I'm going to say it, they impact, I'm going to say the mental, the emotional, the psychological, all domains of a person's functioning. So as we are coming to embrace the idea that we unawarely say things to individuals or to students that can come off as microaggressions, we have to take that culturally humble position, Brian, of having the ability to stop and reflect on what was just said. What was the intent behind what was said? Right?
Yep. Untangling intent and impact. Because of our blind spots, we can microaggress with good intentions. And I think another important thing that I think a lot about in this area is too often the conversation is framed with the goal of tolerance and not belonging. And by that, I mean eliminating a microaggression so that you're flat, so that you're not negatively impacting some, still doesn't make that person who has been marginalized their entire life or is marginalized in this situation feel like that this is a place or a space for them. And so I think a lot about the conversation doesn't always go far enough. I mean, I think we need tolerance maybe before we need belonging. But the grand goal here is that if you and I, as I'm a white male, are both in the same room, I want us both to walk in that room with the same sense of belonging. And I'm aware that that almost never happens in higher education.
I'm going to say it, Brian. I support the American Counseling Association, their new platform based on Dr. Butler's, the election of him being the new president. That platform is inclusion. inclusion to embracing and accepting, I guess, the unknown about others, the unknown about what we think we know about, I guess, how we behave when we're interacting with others, based on even communication, the other platform of advocacy and self-care. We must be attentive to how we are helping others. But at the same time, it requires us to advocate. So the platform of advocacy, self-care, and inclusion, I support that as we are seeking to work with marginalized populations, such as first generation or students of color or individuals that hold the multiple identities that can create those microaggressions that comes from individuals that just don't understand. It starts from awareness and being culturally humble.
Yeah. And I think a lot of our conversation has been spoken more on the individual level, but then at the system level, I really think a lot about psychological safety. And this is sort of a organizational psychology, I think, is where that's most often used in this, but how leaders create institutions where new ideas, questioning of ideas, or observation of actions can be spoken to in a safely, where you don't think that there's going to be negative repercussions against you, or you don't think you might lose your job or not get the promotion. And this is the aspect that I don't know that I see that talked about often enough, of how leadership of institutions have to focus on creating psychological safety so that people can speak into the institution's blind spots as well.
As you're pointing out, and I agree with you 100%, Brian, we are in need of more advocates or leaders in position that are willing to be advocates on behalf of supporting individuals, may that be our students or our clients, supporting them as they are calling out or identifying areas within the system that needs to be disrupted, needs to be dismantled or changed. We need more leaders in position of power to support those individuals. Mm-hmm. This is how change, in my opinion, starts. It starts from the top up, people in leadership positions that hold that power, giving some of that power to support being an ally.
Right. Yeah. So I don't know that we have time on a podcast to say how to do that, but I think what that looks like right now, and again, this is in my mind, I'd love to hear what you think, but right now it seems like the actions being taken are to take the diversity inclusion stuff and put it in a side pocket. And so plenty of crucial conversations, plenty of, like, you know, book groups and things like that. And I think that those, again, are good steps, but it has to happen in the meeting when the actual microaggressions are happening, not as a sided conversation. I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, I have a lot I can say about that, but I know we're limited with time. But one thing I will say, as a woman of color, it first requires our people in power within these systems to at least take that culturally humble position of understanding that, yes, there is a problem here, and we have to go about it in every way to figure out on solving that problem. And that means accepting that they have played a role in that problem, because unfortunately, when you're in a position of power, at times you make decisions that produce or create more problems for the people that are impacted by those decisions. So I guess I'm pointing out that when you're in a leadership position and you have become in tune or aware to your own implicit biases or your blind spots, it's okay to take that into that interaction with individuals so that the work can be done, so that you can unpack those microaggressions, so that you can get to the real issue. Because typically the microaggression is just the surface of the issue. It's a bigger issue that needs to be addressed.
Yeah. Yeah. So I want to turn the conversation, and I had mentioned at the beginning, I was reading an article by Gessing and Glass. And so in the United States, historically, particularly if we look at the Asia Pacific footprint, about 50% of all international students in the U.S. come from China and India. And if we look at them, those two countries, just as an example, their research found that 43% of Chinese international students are indeed first generation students, 20% of students from India are indeed first generation students. One more thing that I'll add, and then I want to ask a question, is we're also seeing this global shift, right? So through the Trump administration and now through the pandemic, U.S. policies have become less accepting of international students. And we're starting to see hubs in new cities. So in the Asia region, we're seeing sort of hubs that are drawing students from that region to places like Seoul, South Korea, to Hong Kong, to Singapore and other countries. Here in the US, because I know that's where you work, how are international student services either integrated or not integrated with US-based students, basically? Like, what do you see out in the field?
Based on my experiences, unfortunately, our international students is another vulnerable, marginalized population within our predominantly white institutions. And I say marginalization based on what's happening with the legal aspect of what's happening in the world. Mm-hmm. And it has trickled down into how these students are either being accepted here or mm-hmm. either being unfortunately rejected. What I'm seeing or what I'm learning just in reading the literature and my interactions with international students here where I work, unfortunately, these students are being isolated. They're not being able to come back. They're losing access to education here in the United States. They are wanting to seek help, but it's just like, unfortunately, the people in power, they're not willing to talk about this. They're not willing to address these biases that we hold about our students that are international. Unfortunately, the biases that center around coming into the United States, the opportunities that's being available, but then the ability for access. So mm-hmm. what I'm seeing is that we, in my opinion, the world is having to make a decision around embracing our students that are all over, but embracing them to the point where we're providing them with access to the services that we have here. May that be higher education, may that be career services, may that be counseling services. We must support our international students because we know for a fact, what I've learned is that there is a surge at this point, according to the U.S. Department of Education, 56% of all college students identify as first generation. But then you have that additional 54% as racial ethnic minorities, Brian. Mm-hmm. Those mm-hmm. racial ethnic minority students can be international students right. that are coming from countries that have been marginalized, that are third world countries. So they're coming here with barriers and then they're encountering more barriers. So that is impacting their mental health. Yeah. So yeah, we have to, I guess, name it.
Yeah. And I would say working in other countries quite a bit, I think a hard thing mm-hmm. that people who serve students in the United States need to grapple with is students from many other countries, particularly in my experience in the Asia Pacific region, which mm-hmm. we often term as more collectivistic. Our response to the pandemic makes no sense to them, mm-hmm. right? Our focus on individualism versus collectivism is a very difficult thing for much of the world to grasp. A second hard truth, and this is my experience in working in these populations, mm-hmm. is that the United States is widely seen as a violent country because of the proliferation of gun violence and racial violence in the past mm-hmm. 4 to 5 years. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's so easy because we are the receiving country. We are the more privileged with the more power in the world. I think it's so easy to turn away from the fact that we don't view these two important things about our current reality like most of the rest of the world. And again, that's Brian Hutchison's opinion, but based on quite a bit of experience.
And Brian, I can see why you have that position. I agree with you that at this point, if we do not have the willingness to broach or to call out or to dismantle these systems that we have here in the United States so that they are more embracive, more accepting, more opening to all culture identities, regardless mm-hmm. of the identities that our students or clients hold, that's the start at mm-hmm. tackling these issues that we're seeing surge that are now on the forefront. Now we can see them. And it's all connected to what I like to rally around, the mental health. Mm-hmm. We can't ignore how all of these things that are happening, may they be in the control of the individual or outside of the control, it's playing a role in the ability for the individual to maintain that healthy functioning, right? Mm-hmm. We have to attend to this because at this point, mental health is, in my opinion, is part of self-care, right? Mm-hmm. Yep. We have to promote our students, our clients to engage in that self-care piece.
I often think, for me and my experience of the world, when oftentimes when things feel the most dire, that's actually because you're at a push point where things could move dramatically. You know, I know in your email that you have a Dr. Martin Luther King quote in your signature line. The 1960 civil rights movement was both one of the most tumultuous social times in the United States, but also one of the times where we saw the most social progress towards fairness and equity. So I don't know that things can feel calm and like they're going well for that magnitude of change to happen, which makes me feel like maybe I'm getting to live through a great moment with you and all of our colleagues during this time.
Yes, this is a time of reckoning, as they're calling it right now. This is the time of awakening, is what I like to call it. Mm-hmm. A time where we accept the truth about the world.
Yeah.
A time where we accept the truth about ourselves, right? And that requires us to accept, I guess, the good, the bad, and the ugly, so that mm-hmm. we can heal, so that we're liberated to make change, so that we are creating a better world. I say the next generation, the next generation, the next generation, and the next generation, because we know that we're producing, or we're working with clients that is going to be continuing on with the evolution of life, right? So it's like, let's make it better.
Well, Janique, whew, I'm all fired up and I don't want to do a 3-hour podcast because that is not our format. So first of all, I think I predicted the future when I said uh-huh. that your passion for this topic would be self-evident in the way that you address it. I think an important element for me, and then I'll let you know, sort of sum up anything that's left unsaid is so this conversation went to some much bigger issues, but at the end of the day, it still is about first generation college students, because they are the most impacted in particularly in college environments, right? They are the mm-hmm. ones with the least amount of cultural and institutional knowledge, mm-hmm. the least amount of resources, and oftentimes, mm-hmm. in my experience, the most amount of hardship in their life, working multiple jobs, raising families, incurring more student debt burden here in the United States, and probably many other things. And so even though I think we did a great job of talking about big things, at the end of the day, this gets focused most of the weight of it on first generation students, whether they're from another culture or not, versus other students. What do you see for the future of your work and of the opportunities to make good change for first gen students?
Oh, Brian, thank you for that question. I'm looking towards the future of examining these systems in which our first generation students of color occupy, mm-hmm. systems that in which they go to seek support from that they're not receiving. Another area of my research that I am heavily focused on, that I am just passionate about because it's part of self-care, which is self-love, which is my new mantra, is all about wellness and spirituality and mm-hmm. finding that inner peace within, because we look to these systems to help us. But if we're not looking within, we won't find that intrinsic peace that we ultimately need as we're battling these barriers or these systems that are out here in this world that's been here for years. We must take care of ourselves in order for us to take care of the next generation.
And so, Janique, if people want to find you and find your work, is there social media or websites or anything? And I'll put these in the show notes, but where they can find and follow you.
Yes, I'm located on Twitter @_Janique. I'm located on LinkedIn. Just find me on social media. You might find me advocating on behalf of some of the different issues that we've discussed here today.
Yeah. And just for our audience, _ Janique would be spelled _JoniqueE. And I do want to do a quick shout out. So you have an article that just came out. It'll be in the August issue of the Journal of College Access.
Mm-hmm.
And if I may, I'm just real quick read the title unless you have it in front of you.
Yes, Promoting Success for First Generation Students of Color, The Importance of Academic Transitional Adjustment and Mental Health Support. Another quick shout out. I'm also producing a piece that's due to come out in Career Convergence for the September issue titled Reframing Career to Care, Understanding Intersectionality and Using Career Life Interventions to Empower Our First Generation College students of color to succeed.
Amazing. And for those of you that may not know, Career Convergence is the online professional magazine for the National Career Development Association in the United States. I believe it is an open access online publication. And so you'll be able to look for that in September. And if you're an NCDA member, email will come out notifying you of its existence. Well, I just want to give the most heartfelt gratitude for you bringing your passion, your joy, and your expertise to this important conversation. That was Dr. Jonique Childs of University of Massachusetts Amherst. This is Global Career Guy Brian Hutchison. I can't wait to see you next time on episode 10.